November the 7th, 1989. This is Earl Mann. I'm taping for the Dearborn County History Project, the Oral History Project, and Jack Anderson, a longtime resident of Greendale and Lawrenceburg, has been gracious enough to let me come into his home, and he was a businessman here in Lawrenceburg, so we're going to talk to him just a little while about the events, especially the 30s. Jack, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your parents, if you'd like.
Well, I'm Jack R. Anderson. I was born in Republic, Missouri in 1911, July the 11th. My grandparents, E.T. Anderson, Elijah Tig Anderson was his name. He's buried there in Republic, and his home is on the National Register, and at this time he has a nephew, well, it's really a son of a niece of his living in the home that he's gotten permission to rebuild it somewhat for them so it'd be more modern. I've buried them all there. My father, my grandfather, my father, and my brother, all the same name, are buried side by side in the Republic Cemetery. My grandfather gave five or seven streets, I believe it is, in the town. All the school buildings are on his property, and so is the cemetery. So he's pretty prominent in Republic, Missouri, but out here his prominence isn't known.
Jack is an early businessman in the early 1930s. Tell us a little bit about the economy of the area for the small businessman.
Well, the economy was good here all through the years that I was in business. I went into business in 1937. Actually, it belonged to Hilda Wright and Cully Fish, and I met them during the flood and I put their store or their little shop back into operation. Ralph Patton had promised to do it if I'd help him, but he never helped me at all. I did it all and put it out in the barn that belonged to Mr. Cook on Ridge Avenue. It's now Linda Moon's property. I put it back in that barn, and 3 days later they asked me to move them, and I moved them down on High Street. And the total charge for both moves was $50. The economy was good in those days. There was lots of wealth here, lots of money. Even the workers worked for distilleries, made good money, and the economy was very good.
Jack, you said you came here in 1932, before the distilleries were running, I believe. Did the business people at that time, was there seemed to be plenty of work for the people before the distilleries operated?
I wasn't aware that was before they operated. I wasn't here very long and didn't learn a lot. I met Art and Verna Seibert, the first people I met here besides the Pattons, and I wasn't aware that the distilleries weren't operating, although the Squibb family came from Missouri. And I hunted on the Squibb property in Missouri a lot of times, hunted coyotes there, and he's a brother to the man that had the distillery here in Lawrenceburg.
In your business, Jack, did the customers come to you, or how did you make contact with them?
Well, my customers came to me, and I came to them. I traveled seven counties in my typewriter work. At first, I was only a printer, but that one didn't keep me busy enough, so I went into the office equipment business. And then I bought the building on East Center Street, which is now part of the, at that time it was the Home Furniture, who had just started after the war. And I bought their building and kept them. So the press office built them a new building. They were going to buy the building I was in. Irvin Laurie was supposed to move in the building with his little dime store off of Walnut Street, but I think he really used me to get a ownership of the other business in town. And it didn't matter because I let laundry in there, and later on I had to buy the laundry, and I ran the laundry and the Peerless printing and the Peerless office equipment and the typewriter repair all myself. And then I took Dale McLeister as a partner and got relieved of some of the printing. My wife and he were great printers, and they liked it. And it left me free to do all these other things, and then I started building a lot for the church and the library and so forth.
Tell us a little bit about the library. You were on the library board for a long time and acquiring some property and helping build that.
I was on the library board for 25 years with the principal of the grade school. Mr. Harrison called me and said they'd put me on the library board, and I want to know why, because I never read books at that time at all. And he said, we had something else in mind for you, and I was made chairman of the building committee that first meeting. And the library at that time was small, and we put all their books over in the little house next to Methodist Church, where my wife had taught Sunday school. I tore that house down when I built the new Sunday school, moved the scout cabin. And I got all the land around the library vacated. The alley is vacated now. However, I made them leave it open for the public's use until they wanted to use it for parking lot. And I built a little stand with the grass in it after I went off the board. After I'd built the library, why, I went off the board and built the garden wall and the garden. And I bought the Frederick House and the old Barrett home, and then bought the Reagan Hotel so that we'd have a place for parking and for future building. And they've now built on all that property that I bought west of the library. I put a complete heating system and two complete restrooms and an office and a charge counter in the old library. I thought that would be permanent and that they'd just build a room on the west side, but they've remodeled all of it and rebuilt the whole thing, so it's quite a library now. It's good enough for New York City, you might say. Madison and Batesville have nothing on us at this time about a library.
Okay, you mentioned the Methodist Church, and I know you were active in it, and your wife taught there. Tell us something a little bit about, say, the religious practices of the people in the 30s, in the Depression, as compared, say, now when the economy is fairly good. Can you see any difference?
I can see a terrible big difference. In the days of when I met my wife, church was the in thing. Everybody went to church, children and all. There was probably 30-some in Hilda's little class. And now they're trying to start a Sunday school in the building that I built, and I built a two-story building with lots of space for 12 classes. And now they have no classes. They're trying to start one or two classes now. I remember when Hilda retired from her teaching, the little girl up the street took her class and named it the Moose Juice class, if you can believe that. That's what she named the class, and it all went to pieces, the whole thing. I had air conditioned Hilda's room, and she had a nice room, had a nice display there, religious things. And church was quite the thing in the old days, and now it's got to be almost nothing. Nobody bothers about it anymore.
Along with the church, you're close to education and the teachers and principals of the schools here and the superintendents. What about education, say, of the youth at that time? Did you notice many of them quitting to take jobs because of the Depression?
No, not too many. I called Mr. Mack one day and told him I'd like to hire a boy to clean my presses. He sent me a boy over. And the next night, the boy had big gauntlet gloves on. I asked him what the gloves were for, and he said his mother didn't want him to get ink on his hands. So I told him, well, maybe this is not the job for you. And I called Mr. Mack, and I said, can you send me another boy? This boy didn't want to get ink on his hands. You're going to get ink on your hands in a print shop. So he sent me a little black boy, Nathan Childers. He worked for me for about 25 years. He's still working for me. He still does everything that I have done. I only have to pay him $5 an hour now, and I used to pay him less than 50 cents an hour. But things are different today in labor, too. I didn't notice many kids quitting school, too. They just didn't quit school in those days. They went to high school. They didn't go to college like they do now, but they didn't quit school, not for jobs. If they get a job, they got the job, but it had to be after school on Saturday and Sunday. I never got Nate steady until he got out of school.
How about social clubs and service clubs like sororities, Alliance Club, and lodges? You were active in some of those. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those?
Well, the Lions Club and the Kiwanis, I belong to the Lions Club and the Kiwanis both. That, I hate to say this where it can be repeated, but I told them when I resigned that I had a bigger program of my own than they had as an organization, and I did have. Of course, at that time, I started the playgrounds under Bob Baker, the mayor, and I was quite busy with the building around town, especially in the section around the library. I built about all of that, the parking lots and the church and the Sunday school and the scout cabin, all of those things I built. We rode donkeys to pay the Greendale building. I remember we played donkey baseball to get the logs to build that building. What else was she was asking me?
What about some other recreation you mentioned besides the clubs, besides donkey baseball? What else kind of recreation did you have?
There wasn't any recreation here until Bob Baker put me on the playground commission. And then I built 8 playgrounds and 2 swimming pools. We built the Tate Street Shelter House, and I put windows in it later on and taught through the Walter out here in Greendale. He was a Lawrenceburg boy at that time. Ralph Patton cut all the bars for me, and we taught Eddie Roush to weld, and Eddie Roush welded up all of the windows on the Tate Street Playground building for me. And he went to the South Pole with Admiral Byrd 3 times as a welder. So that's one good deed I remember I did, and I've always been proud of that. He learned to weld for us. When Arnie Bear and I built the first swimming pool, we decided to build another one and build a little bigger. And we built a better one, and I got the boat trip away from the Businessmen's Club 1 year, and it burned. And I made $1,500 that year, and I hired Pat O'Neill for the summer and Bud Bateman. We were trying to give them jobs in the summer, keep them here. We didn't want them to get away from us. They were good men.
Can you tell us about some of your experiences as announcer for some of these games? I used to listen to you quite a lot in the high school gym and other places.
Well, when we started football, I started football here. I'll never forget the night I went over to the board and told them I wanted to start football, and they laughed at me and said, "This is basketball country. Football will never go over here." And I said, "Now let me tell you what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid football will de-emphasize basketball to the point we won't have much basketball." And I said, "Football will pay for all your sports before you're done. It'll be the biggest sport you got." And they couldn't believe that. They only let me start 6 man, but didn't have any money, so I had to go out and raise the money to buy the equipment. And since then, I've been buying it every year. Bob Myers told me the other day he had to buy 40 new helmets, took it out of my money. Then I paid $500 to get us in the Hall of Fame up at some place they're building a Hall of Fame, and it cost $500 to get a school enrolled. And Bob asked me for the $500, and I gave it to him. I'd already put $100 in for myself. Sports was the thing then. And they are now. In fact, the matter is they've overdone the sports, I think. And when I endowed the school for Mr. Couch, who I consider is the best man we ever had, I did fix it so they couldn't go too far with sports. I put up $10,000 for one sport. That's for the athletic scholarship for the boy and the girl that got the athletic scholarship. And I put $20,000 up for the teachers who were outstanding. We need outstanding teachers. We're not getting them anymore. Back in the old days, my teacher was won the national debate team for the whole nation. She's married and an elderly woman, very homely, big and stout, and had 2 children in high school. And was a wonderful teacher. We had a lot of wonderful teachers in those days, but we don't have them anymore. Kids are going through college and getting these teaching jobs. They don't care a thing about the student. They don't care anything about their future. All they care about is their own future. That's my opinion.
How about the Ohio River? It's changed quite a bit since that period of time, the 1930s. How important was the Ohio River then for business, for recreation? Do you remember anything about that?
Yes. The river was more important then than it is now, it seems, although today they bring such large boats up with oil and other things on it. We have unloading places we didn't have in those days. They used to unload down on the end of Walnut Street. My wife used to tell me about it. Said you could hear them on Sunday, the beer barrels rolling around on Sunday. There was a lot of beer. There were 22 saloons here in those days, they tell me. I've been trustee of the Reese Estate now for the past 30 years, and they tell me they came down the river on a flatboat in 1803 and built a log house on what is now the Reese Estate. There are two houses on the estate. I've remodeled both of them. And last year was my best year. At the time I took it over, they weren't giving the church a dime. Last year I gave the church $9,000. And the retired minister that lived in the house, I couldn't get a local man, so I went down to conference and got a man from over in Riley, Indiana. He just left there and went back to Indianapolis to be near his son and the doctors, because he and his wife are not either one very well. I'm going to send him money this year. I told him I'd give him 7/12 of whatever I had for him this year. I'll know that at the end of the year when I make up my report. But the Reese Estate, they own the entire valley from Lawrenceburg to Aurora, to Wilson Creek, rather. They had a land grant from Pennsylvania for 1,200 acres, and they owned the entire valley. They had a ferry boat on Tanner's Creek, and they had a toll road to Aurora. And Hilda used to tell me about, she was born in 1890. She told me about 99 it was, 1899. She told me when they used to rent horses from the Fitch Funeral Home. Every Sunday they'd rent a horse and carriage and drive down to her grandmother's on Lower Conwell in Aurora.
What is the location of these Fitch houses now? Or not the Fitch, but the Reese House.
Well, the Reese House is located where the ramp is that goes down to the marina.
Oh, yeah.
That's all the Mary and Martha Reese land that I farm. They have a tenant house there. They used to have a tenant living in. That first thing I did, I took over, had him kicked out and paid him rent for 13 years. I took that job to make money for the church. They left the farm to the church trustees with the stipulation that 75% of the net income would be used to remodel the church and do repairs, and 25% would go to a retired minister who would live in the home. Now, the first will they left was so that Reverend Wilson could live in the home, and after he deceased, and let his wife live in the home. And then after he was gone, it's to be retired ministers from our church. If none were available, then they had to be from our conference. Now this year, I've had every local man turn me down that preached here, that are still living and retired. They've all turned me down. So I got Reverend Gauss's name, I believe it is, from Aurora. I'm going to try to get him in there. But right today, the house is empty, and I'm wanting to remodel, but I'm too weak to do it. And my nephew gets here, he'll probably help me do some of it.
Now, this house is the white frame house.
It's the big brick house.
Big brick house.
Yeah.
Before you turn to go down to the marina.
Just as you turn. Well, it's after you get past the marina road. It's got a big front yard that runs down to the highway.
Okay.
And it's this side of Harry Pellman.
Okay.
In fact, they own Harry Pellman. They sold Harry Pellman 10.5 acres for $3,000. And the church recently sold Greendale 26.5 acres for $115,000. And Greendale just sold 2.5 acres of that to the Ford agency over here for $17,500 an acre. So if you think the price isn't going up, well, that'll give you a good idea.
Jack, Lawrenceburg and Greendale, you know, because of their location, I know you've been interested in this for a long time, in one local unit, one local government. What, you got any comments on that?
Yes, I have. I won't sleep in my grave very well until I know these two towns are to one. There's no excuse for the residential section of a town not being associated with its business section. I never heard of such a thing in all my life. I realize that Charlie Loeb did the wrong thing, but Chester Bilby was your attorney in Greendale, and he was defending Greendale against Orangeburg, and he told me before he died, he and I became great friends. He told me before he died he only had 73% of the signers in Greendale, and if Lawrenceburg had continued, they'd have won the case. And I said, why'd you do that? And he said, Chet said, you know, I wanted Greendale and Lawrenceburg together as much as any man did. But when I have a job to do, I do the job. And I said, I know that, Chet, and I admire you for it. If Chet had told everybody at that time what he told me later, and I never told it. I was working for Henkel when I came back here off the road. Mr. Henkel got mad at me. I always called him Mr. Henkel, although I sometimes refer to him as Louie. He got a little mad at me because I drove from way down Brownstown, Texas, all the way to Michigan, and Pat paid me my 40 cents an hour for driving. He said I should have paid them bus fare. And he told me it'd be a good time to go back to St. Louis. He'd just being smart. I said, I think I'll walk out Seagram's and go to work. He said, yeah, I'd like to see that. So I walked out Seagram's and went right to work. I wasn't in the electrical gang because that was my principal trade, although I was doing 11 and 12 crafts every day. And he knew what a good man I was. I had a man on the road offer me, had me out to dinner one night. I was making 40 cents an hour, and he offered me, he said, the most I can pay you is 2.5 an hour, and I know you're making more than that. I can't ask you, I can't offer you any more than that, so there's no use me talking to you about working for me. 2.5 an hour, and I was making 40 cents. I went right on working for 40 cents. That's what I got at Seagram's, but I got three promotions over there. The first week I was there, they laid off 250 men, and I got laid off with him. Of course, I was one of the newest men they'd hired. And it was fair that I'd be laid off. But my boss called the bottling out and said, I got a man who works so hard to be ashamed to lay him off. You need him. You need a good man down there. He's going to go in the electrical gang someday. And they said, send him down. And I went down there and got three promotions in just a few weeks. One day I worked for Perry Carver, and I came back into the import room, and he said, what's this I hear about you? I said, I don't know, what did you hear? And he said, I heard you was throwing a case every time Clark threw one. I said, what's wrong with that? He said, you can't throw cases with Clark, he'll kill you. I said, I never met a man I couldn't work beside and keep up with him. And he said, well, you're taking an awful chance trying to throw a case every time Clark throws one. But I did. And that's why I got three promotions. I was a car diagram when I left there. When the flood came in, Mr. Jennings, the man I worked for in the bottling house, he was the head of the bottling house, a fine gentleman if I ever met one. One day they wanted to search me, and I wouldn't be searched. And they took me into his office, and he said, what seems to be wrong? And I said, well, they're trying to search me. I said, Mr. Jennings, if you don't trust me, fire me. I'm honest. I don't use your product, and if I did, I'd carry it down in the wastebasket and throw it under the fence and pick it up at night. And from that day to now, they send a policeman with everybody that dumps trash. They never did search me, though.
Saying that in the late 1930s, how about women working in factories or businesses? Were there been many applying? I'm sure there weren't as many working as there are now, but what do you remember about women working?
The thing I remember about women working in those days, they were all in offices. None of them worked on the lines. They worked in the office as secretaries and so forth. And they were beginning to go to business college. My wife and her sister both went to business college. And my wife was a typist. But that's about all the women did in those days, was type and work in offices. They didn't work out in the field. Now you see them working on the highway.
Right.
They work everywhere today. Of course, with the prices, they ran the price up themselves, though. When I worked for Shell in St. Louis, I could buy 17 pounds of the best bacon made for a dollar. 17 pounds of the best bacon made for $1. today you can't buy a pound of it for that. And the only reason is because their wages have gotten so high. 40 cents an hour, everybody said, well, that money would buy so much. It only bought me board and room and a car and some decent clothes. That's all I ever had.
What did the 1937 flood cost you in terms of your business operation?
Well, I really got into the business at that time. I came across the levee one morning where they were building the new sewage disposal plant, and two girls pulled up in the car and wanted to borrow my lantern, and it turned out to be Hilda Wright, that I married later, and Cully Fish, her partner, in the Peerless Printing Company. And I told them I couldn't loan them a lantern because it was a coal oil, or a gasoline lantern, and they wouldn't know how to use it. They wanted to start the furnace in their house. I asked them if they knew Ralph Patton, and they said yes. I said, well, he'll loan you a coal oil lamp. He's got a lot of them. So they went over and borrowed a coal oil lamp, and I went on to work. And the next thing I knew, there was those same two girls down in the engine room at the flour mill talking with Ralph Patton, and he called me down the upstairs engine room. We had two small engines up there making power. I was working up there in the panel. He called me down, and that's when he asked me if I'd help them move their shop, because they'd been up on High Street, and it was all full of mud and everything. And I turned them down again. That's the second time I turned them down. And he said, if I'll take the job, would you help me? And I told him I would. And I had to do the job alone. He never did show up. Although I had to help, I was staying at his brother's house. I had to clean my own room. And Mr. Jennings told me not to leave. I went to him and asked him if I could go get my stuff. He said, anything you lose, Sigrams will take care of it. I never told him I lost anything, so Sigrams didn't have to take care of anything. I was always fair with Sigrams. And I think if people would ask Sigrams, they'd be fair with the town, too. Ralph is the man that told me they pumped 10 to 12 million gallons of water a day. I did a favor of Mr. Jennings. He had 350 cases of import whiskey on a sub-level. I cut a hole in the concrete floor and saved those 350 cases. We shoved it up through a conveyor. I had, there's 14 of us left there. That's all that stayed with Mr. Jennings. The rest of them left.
Jack, give us a little bit about your impression for the development of the area around Lawrenceburg and Aurora.
I think there are great possibilities here for development, as well as they are in Kentucky. But it'll never happen to a divided community. A community divided against itself, a house divided against itself, can only fail. I've said that before, and I'll say it again. Whenever they get together and work together for a common cause, the chances of development here are great. I think Lawrenceburg would be a fool to let Greendale develop any further than they have. And I've said so in the past, and I'll say it again. It's wrong. A divided community will never be successful. No one wants to come where there are people fighting. And you know that. I know that. Everybody knows that. But nobody does. We got a few politicians out here that want to have a town of their own to do what they please, because the voting public is the most ignorant people in the world. My contention is you should vote for the new man every time, and I do. I vote for the man that's throwing the other man out of office, because they don't have to be in there very long. And it gets to be very lucrative. Too many propositions for him. I think that was awful that time. No, it wasn't.
Okay, this is Earl Mann again. I certainly want to thank Jack Anderson for his thoughts and his recollections here during the 1930s and 1940s. Okay, Jack's got another comment here.
About the new road up to the hospital, I was so instrumental in the hospital building in Lawrenceburg instead of down the road. And Greendale and Lawrenceburg both have the benefit of having the hospital. But Greendale, I wrote the state of Indiana and suggested they bring the road down from the playground through the Lawrenceburg Industrial Park to the foot of the street here, this next street. What is this? Two streets. Probasco. Bring it to the foot of Probasco and let Lawrenceburg and Greendale build a bridge across it. Then take it on through Greendale and down through the Greendale Industrial Park and out to Highway 50. They need a new road to the hospital. Now, that's an unselfish thing on my part, because I, being in charge of the Reese Estate, would be a great benefit to me to run the road down by the Reese Estate and let them build on it, let me sell ground to build on or lease it. I don't want to sell any ground, I want to lease. I don't believe in ever turning loose of your principal. That's been something I've always said. And I've made more money since I moved out here in Grand Hill to pass away than I ever made in my life, because I used the principal to get the interest. And I think I've written in the paper about this road, and I don't know what they're... I still think the state has already made up their mind to build the road down to 50.
Okay, Jack, thanks again for your time. Certainly appreciate it.